You're tuned to 103.5 WCOMLP, Chapel Hill and Carrboro's 100-watt wonder. Listener-supported community radio.
This is Psych Talk, the podcast. I'm Jose Dras Lopez. Psych Talk brings you interviews and stories that explore why people think and act the way they do. This is the second show in a series on schizophrenia. And this time we're asking, what are the different symptoms of schizophrenia? How is it expressed in the brain? And how do researchers find new insights and treatments? Our neuroscience expert to explain all this and more is Dr. Fred Yarskog. He's the research director of the North Carolina Psychiatric Research Center and a professor in the Department of Psychiatry at UNC Chapel Hill. Dr. Yarskog's research is focused on the pathophysiology and treatment of schizophrenia. Let's get right into the interview. Stay with us.
You're listening to Psych Talk.
Dr. Yarskog, welcome to the show.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Tell us about the work you're doing, both at the Research Center in Raleigh and also at UNC, what you're up to, what's keeping you busy.
So right now I'm working primarily at, as you said, the North Carolina Psychiatric Research Center. This is a collaboration that we have with the state-supported hospital, Central Regional Hospital, and it represents an outpatient clinic at the old Dorothea Dix Hospital campus in Raleigh. And for a long time, historically, there was an inpatient unit at Dorothea Dix Hospital that was a research unit where we conducted inpatient research. And after the close of Dorothea Dix Hospital, we were able to set out an outpatient research clinic remaining on the Dorothea Dix campus. And so this is where we see a lot of patients and we treat patients, but these patients also have the opportunity to participate in research studies. And so a lot of our clinical research with patients with schizophrenia is done there. Now, we also do some work like this here at UNC Chapel Hill, and I also see more patients clinically at Chapel Hill, but most of the research is done in Raleigh.
Mm. So just a general identity question, do you feel like you're split between being a clinician and a researcher, or do you think of yourself as strictly a researcher?
No, I think it's really... You really can't be a researcher without also being a clinician. And I think that you have to treat patients to be able to effectively identify, you know, what are the problems that patients are having? What are the things that we need to improve on? Where are the gaps in knowledge? And what sort of new treatments do we need to be trying to develop?
Right. That makes sense. And you're working with people. It's not like researching just... rocks or molecules, objects. You're trying to help people and give them hope for a better treatment.
That's right. That's right.
When you're working at the North Carolina Psychiatric Research Center, tell me a bit about the patients who are coming in. Do they find out about the center as just a local place to find treatment, or is the research component sold to them as something that gives them extra value for going there?
Right. So this clinic was set up in 2010, right after the close of the Dorothea Dix Hospital. And so some of the patients that we had been serving both in the inpatient unit at Dorothea Dix and also a small outpatient component there, they sort of came with us to this new outpatient clinic. But we really have been working with the Wake County mental health system to try to make our services available to patients within the whole Wake County system and even surrounding counties for the purpose of really both being a place where people can get top-notch clinical care, but also have the opportunity to participate in research. Because research, you know, one of the primary sort of tenets of doing research is that it is a voluntary participation of any individual. We can't mandate that anyone participate. So we begin by offering clinical service to patients in the area. And then we also let them know that as part of being in this clinic, you're going to have the opportunity, and you will sometimes be asked whether you might be interested in participating in a research study. And there may be some selection in our clinic towards people who are, on average, more interested in doing research. But we certainly also serve people that are probably never going to participate in a research study. And that's okay. Our mandate is really, and our mission is twofold. It's to provide clinical care and also to do research.
Mm. Do you have any sense that the people who have a willingness to participate, who are maybe even eager to participate, are somehow adding a confound to your studies, like they're more extroverted or more open to new experiences? Anything that would affect the sorts of schizophrenia you're seeing?
That's probably true to some extent. I think that every study has to be carefully designed, and that sort of goes back to what we always, when we design a study, we have certain inclusion criteria and exclusion criteria. So we make these criteria that the criteria themselves should select for an appropriate group of patients that will yield interpretable results. Now that's maybe a little bit vague, but I think that the reality is there are always going to be confounds, potential issues around the people that participated that may kind of make the results not completely clear cut or leave question marks at the end of the study. Mm. However, you try to minimize those confounds by making the inclusion and exclusion criteria as clear and precise as possible. But, you know, I think of one particular aspect of patients with schizophrenia. It's something that we call negative symptoms. And this has to do it doesn't mean negative in a bad kind of way, but it means the idea that people are generally sort of they remove themselves from social situations. They tend maybe not to speak a lot. They tend to have a relatively flat affect or don't show a lot of emotion and don't have a desire to socialize or to show emotion or sort of a neutral and sort of a not a very engaging kind of aspect to a lot of people who have schizophrenia. Mm-hmm. And this is seen as a major reason why people with schizophrenia have problems functioning in society, because there needs to be sort of a motivation and a desire to participate in a lot of activities in society to be successful. And so only recently have real efforts been made in trying to understand, is there a neurobiology to the negative symptoms? Because antipsychotic medications, although they may treat some of the other more obvious symptoms of schizophrenia, like hallucinations and paranoia and delusions, they seem to not do anything to these negative symptoms. And so, I'm taking a long way to get around to the point I was thinking about. It's that if you're trying to do a study about patients with negative symptoms, how do you even, how do you find those patients? Because they're not going to present to the clinic, because they're not interested. They would rather sit at home and spend their time, you know, maybe watching television or at the very least not going out and actively looking for participation in a research project that's going to put them potentially in uncomfortable social situations that they wouldn't want. So how do you even find the patients to study? And so although we're trying to study people with negative symptoms, and we're trying to figure out ways to improve treatment, that's an example of where you're probably, you know, you're more likely to have problems identifying the people for the problem that you're actually trying to address. Hmm.
I like that you started introducing this idea of negative symptoms, and I want to round it out because there's this constellation of symptoms that's involved in schizophrenia, and the flip side of these symptoms of absence of normal traits is the positive symptoms. And you've already introduced what they are, but tell us a little bit more about that distinction.
And so, and just, you know, sort of for the sake of simplicity, you know, we talk about positive and negative symptoms. But the positive symptoms are really these what people might think of more characteristically as symptoms of schizophrenia, which is when people experience hallucinations, and these can be usually are in the form of auditory hallucinations. So they hear things that others around don't hear. And they can also be visual sometimes, and they can affect all the senses. They can be, you know, sense of smell. They can be touch. So hallucinations is one of the main positive symptoms. The other one is delusions, and you know, a delusion means a false belief. And so you might think that the CIA is following you when they in fact are not. The feelings of paranoia often stem from delusional thoughts, the idea that maybe someone is paying unusual attention to you. And they can be either what we say non-bizarre or bizarre. The idea that the CIA is following you is non-bizarre. I mean, it's probably unlikely, but it's within the realms of possibility. Right. Or the idea could be that it's completely implausible, like the idea that you're communicating with someone who, you know, a colony of individuals living on Pluto, and that's probably more bizarre. But you know, the delusions can span any sort of false belief.
Right.
And those are you have the positive symptoms and the negative symptoms, and then in addition to that, and kind of linked to positive symptoms, but are really the cognitive deficits. And the cognitive deficits can both be sort of a mental state of, you know, disorganization, or also kind of behavioral disorganization, where people act in ways that isn't really purposeful. They may be behaviorally sort of moving or sort of doing things that really just don't make sense, and it seems purposeless. But really, the biggest problem is the cognitive problems, which the disorganization and the difficulty with concentration, with memory, these sort of things, very much part and parcel of the problems that people with schizophrenia have, and really contribute a lot to the functional problems that they ultimately have, the difficulty in terms of, you know, keeping a job, going to school, doing the kind of things that you know, that's really kind of required to be a fully participating member in our society.
Right. When you talk about these cognitive symptoms, I think about how the word cognitive sometimes has this sort of intellectual meaning, like it has to do with IQ tests. But it's really something that manifests itself in everyday life that everyone can see. You can see the disorganized thought manifesting itself. Yep. But I am curious, does the cognitive component of schizophrenia often manifest itself in like traditional measures of intelligence, paper and pencil sort of things, or does it take more probing to notice?
Yeah. I would say overall it takes more probing. I mean, I think that when people are quite ill, let's say they present at the hospital at the emergency room and require inpatient hospitalization just to be safe physically, you will see anyone could notice the disorganization. But when people are doing well and are, you know, in outpatient treatment and are not having acute symptoms, many people still have fairly profound cognitive deficits when you test them. But it may not come across right away, especially if they have, you know, reasonably, you know, kind of normal social skills. They can communicate and carry out ordinary activities without it being profoundly. But if you test them in neurocognitive testing and look at reaction time and look at how well can they remember things, kind of like we talk about working memory. Working memory is kind of like you would do when you have to remember a phone number, for instance. You're told a phone number and then you have to keep that in mind until you dial the number. That kind of memory is very much impaired compared to the standard standard average person who does not have schizophrenia. So we see deficits that really impact on function, but they're not all that readily apparent. Mm. I think that's at least how I see it. And I think We have to usually do pretty extensive neurocognitive testing to really define those deficits.
Right, right. Now, Dr. Yarskog, I'm going to interrupt for just a moment to make an announcement. We had a call at the station, but we're not taking calls this hour. What we do is, if you want to send comments or start a follow-up conversation, you can tweet us at psychtalk_tweet, or you can email us at psychtalk@wcomfm.org. Our website is psychtalkradio.com. Now let's jump back into what we were talking about. This idea that there are different symptoms of schizophrenia, and one side is these cognitive symptoms that can affect sort of short-term memory, which we now call working memory, things like memorizing a phone number. It can affect reaction times. And I'm going to stop there. What would a typical reaction time task be that would identify a schizophrenic person or show potential schizophrenic symptoms?
Well, just how quickly you respond to a stimulus. And this is not rocket science kind of thing. It's just having to react to some. So if they're being told to tap a button when they see a stimulus on a screen, like a shape, that would just be measuring that time to actually react. And that was just an example of one measure that's longer in patients. But again, there can be. For reaction time, there can be reasons that we don't necessarily know that all of these deficits are even part and parcel of the illness. They could be secondary to the medication. And a lot of the cognitive research that we do is often confounded by the medicines they're on. And you can't do the research when people are off the medicine because, in part, they're usually too actively. They might be too actively psychotic, or they can't stop the medicine because that wouldn't be ethical. And so there are a lot of questions in terms of cognition and how to treat in schizophrenia that are very difficult to answer. And we're working on those things. But with regards to reaction time, I just said that I made it as an example, but it's not necessarily all that helpful. When you just consider it as by itself in terms of a patient, it certainly is not going to help you diagnose a patient with schizophrenia.
Right. And I'm glad you mentioned diagnosis because it brings me to this overriding hope that society has that we'll get to objective diagnoses and they hear about measures of reaction times or working memory and they think, all right, that's something sort of quantifiable. Maybe we're getting closer to an objective diagnosis, a sort of sci-fi world where you walk through a scanner and it says, boop, boop, you have schizophrenia, and just certainty in the sort of uncertain world that we live in. And it's not quite that simple, but let's look at schizophrenia as it manifests itself in the brain and give us a sense of what things we know are strongly associated with schizophrenia and what things are just markers that really don't tell us that much. So there, for example, are disruptions in certain brain regions, right, that we can find if we're looking for them, like with a brain scanner, with fMRI. Tell us a bit about that.
So I think that the search for what we really call biomarkers, sort of these biological markers or findings that you could use to either make a diagnosis or kind of identify the person with schizophrenia, There's a lot of excitement around it because, as you said, it could potentially lead to more precise diagnosis, and it could help you really more understand the illness from a perspective that could help you then design better treatments. But overall, I think it's misleading to suggest that we really have solid understanding of biomarkers when it comes to schizophrenia that are really help. There are no biomarkers right now that really can be helpful to diagnose schizophrenia. And I think that schizophrenia remains a diagnosis that is made based on clinical observation of the person. And I think that, your question was, what are the biomarkers? And one of the things that's been found that probably correlates, most strongly when we talk about neuroimaging is enlargement of the ventricles. The ventricles are these fluid-filled cavities inside the brain that contain cerebrospinal fluid. And they tend to be significantly larger in about 30 to 40% of patients with schizophrenia. So that's interesting. But plenty of people who don't have schizophrenia also have enlarged ventricles. And just because people with schizophrenia have enlarged ventricles, there isn't really a strong correlation with prognosis or response to a specific medication, which had, at various times people have looked at these sort of things. Profoundly large ventricles does correlate somewhat with worse outcome and sort of worse course. Mm. But it's not as helpful as you might think. The brain is pretty amazing organ, and there's a lot we don't know about how it works, but it manages to work quite effectively despite a lot of problems with it. It figures out how to kind of work and often fix itself too. And we know that from people who, have serious injuries and other illnesses. And they may be, very, very impaired for a while, but then, as they go through rehabilitation and things, the brain really knows often how to kind of fix itself. And I think to some extent, the same thing can be said for schizophrenia. I think there are some real problems that are underlying this disorder, and it's partly genetic. Clearly, we know that there are genes that predispose for schizophrenia, but we haven't really been very good at finding which particular ones. Probably because there's such a large array of different genes that contribute to it, and then there are also environmental factors, and a lot of them seem to be early in development, and we know that, and we think this idea of large ventricles, the ventricles are kind of shaped and formed in mid gestation or so. So it actually points to probably an involvement of early development that has to do with developing schizophrenia. But it still is all kind of, it's not specific. And plenty of people with schizophrenia have completely normal sized ventricles. And so it just becomes kind of it's something that you can use for trying to understand the illness from a research perspective, but it doesn't help diagnose the illness. And I think that you could take most of the biomarkers that have been found. And another example is, for instance, if you look at the level of the neuron, and you look at the dendrites, which are these sort of processes that stick out from the nucleus, from the cell body of the neuron, and each dendrite has these little sort of knobs on it that are called dendritic spines. Mm. And it's at the level of the dendritic spines that you have a synapse, where the one neuron communicates with another neuron. And the number or the density of these dendritic spines is significantly lower in patients with schizophrenia. And that's interesting from a research standpoint, and that observation has been made in a number of studies. This has been done in post-mortem studies. So after people with schizophrenia have died, they've donated the brain to a brain bank where it could then be studied by researchers. And these observations have been made. Again, this is not something that's found in all people with schizophrenia, and likewise in people that don't have schizophrenia, some of their dendritic spines are reduced as well. So it doesn't. I think you could take each of these findings and kind of show that there's so much overlap between people without schizophrenia and people with schizophrenia that the shift in the means between the two populations is helpful in terms of trying to understand the illness. Hmm. But we don't have, an algorithm that kind of says, well, if you have A and B and C and D of these different findings, then you have schizophrenia. That it's we're not at that point. And it the more, you know, I look at this illness, and I think, you know, I think my point of view is probably shared by most researchers. You know, it's kind of like, it seems unlikely that we're going to find a single or even a kind of a set of findings that are readily going to point to a diagnosis that's helpful. And this, I think, even extends to the genetic underpinnings of schizophrenia, that the more we understand about the genes, and now with the Human Genome Project, the human genome has been completely mapped. It's just getting more complicated. Hmm. We thought it would get less complicated, but it's getting more complicated because of these very complex interactions between all the different genes and the different modifications that can be sort of occur with all the different genes. Turns out there probably isn't going to be a clear genetic profile either. And I don't know that that's necessarily, some people might say, well, this is sort of depressing, and why are you even doing this work? Because, you know, you're not really getting to these fundamental issues. But I think it's still, we're learning about the illness, and I think ultimately it will help for defining new and better treatments. I don't know that it's... It's still clear that both in terms of diagnosis and in terms of treatments that are going to help large numbers of people, that they're still kind of far off. Hmm. because it's really daunting in terms of what we don't know.
Hmm. You mentioned that even though these biomarkers are really just markers and not known causes that can be fed into some algorithm, that they still are helpful potentially for treatment. And I'll throw out one other thing that maybe they're helpful for. Maybe for early diagnosis, is that a hope too? Okay, so maybe helpful for treatment for early diagnosis. What does it say to you about the brain or about our knowledge of the brain that we do have to restrict our hopes for what to do with biomarkers? One thing I hear bandied about from neuroscience popularizers is, look, the brain is the most complex organ in our body, pretty much the most complex machine we study, so give us a break. There are a lot of variables going on. Is that what you take out of it, or do you think there's something else we need to learn from the trouble we're having?
Well, I would generally agree with that. I think in part, it is an incredibly complex organ that, if you take it from the perspective of psychiatry, in particular, as opposed to neuroscience, but neuroscience has developed a lot more recently with sort of the advent of the molecular laboratory based techniques that could meaningfully study this. But if you take other areas of medicine and other areas, I think of things like cardiology. You know, they were identifying illnesses of the heart as biological problems far earlier than psychiatry as a field kind of accepted that. At its heart, it's really a biological illness. These are illnesses of the brain, and that they need to be treated as medical illnesses with sort of neurobiological problems. And that perspective hasn't really been in place until, really in like the 1980s is where that kind of research started. Maybe a little bit in the 1970s, but not until the last couple of decades that it's really been in earnest, that it's been studied as a biological illness. And I'm talking in particular about schizophrenia, but it translates to most psychiatric disorders. Mm. Whereas many areas of medicine that have focused, on different areas of the body, and cardiology is an example, but, you take, all areas of medicine, they've been focusing on their particular organ. And without any question, they've been dealing with it as a biological illness for the better part of the last century. So there's cumulative gains that have been made in all these other areas of medicine that only recently have really, at the same intensity, level of intensity, has the attention has been focused on psychiatric disorders. So I think psychiatry and psychiatric illnesses are just kind of, in part, they're just trying to catch up. And I think even though we have very sophisticated techniques both in terms of imaging and molecular biology and genetics and, you know, bringing all these things to bear on this illness, we're still kind of just behind. And I think that it is a matter of, you know, over time there will be advances. But I think that, not to go too much in a different direction, but I think that, at least from a standpoint of treatment, when you look at true treatment advances that have been made, especially in psychiatry, you know, they were, most of them, maybe almost all of them, have been serendipitous. There was not a calculated testing of a hypothesis to develop the medicines that are currently kind of the cornerstones of treatment. And so Thorazine, which is a dopamine receptor blocker, which is, to date, what all antipsychotic medications still have to have that property to be effective. Thorazine was discovered in the mid-1950s. And unfortunately, I say, just as a sort of to sort of acknowledge the fact that we haven't moved beyond that fundamental property in a medication to treat schizophrenia since the mid-1950s. So, a lot of things in science are serendipitous, are sort of happened by chance, and despite all of the sort of wealth of money and expertise and attention that's been poured into trying to develop better treatments, we certainly have developed a lot, many new treatments, many new medications for schizophrenia. But with the exception of one, maybe, none of them have been particularly better than Thorazine in terms of treating hallucinations and delusions. Now, they do have fewer of certain kinds of side effects that Thorazine does, but many of them have other kinds of problems. And so, in terms of making advances in terms of treatment, you know, it's a slow process. It's difficult to sort of really plan for what kind of advances are going to be made. And, you know, who knows? But it might take 20 or 30 years through sort of dogged effort. We might be able to say, oh, that mechanism, that biological mechanism, if we address that with a medication, then that's going to make people better, and it actually works. I mean, that's possible. But it could also be that sort of by chance, someone tries something that just wasn't really, expected, and it turns out that it has a really a Thorazine-like effect, and it has nothing to do with the dopamine receptor. And I think that if we could find something that works through a dramatically different mechanism, that's the kind of thing that actually going to make a big difference for people who are currently suffering and are not helped by the current type of antipsychotic medications that are out there.
Right. Let's fill out this picture of the breakthrough that might happen, that we might finally find a really revolutionary drug, because I'm thinking about how institutional review boards that approve trials have maybe gotten a bit stricter over time. Do you think that this accident or serendipity that would bring us forward might start with animal research? Is that a fair part of the picture? I do think that rats and animal models are used in studying schizophrenia, right?
Mm-hmm.
Tell us a bit about how that works, how you can get at schizophrenia at all with anything other than a human.
Yeah. I mean, that there are... So you can model certain neurobiological deficits. Again, it sort of comes back to this biomarker thing, that you can sort of model types of deficits that patients with schizophrenia might have, and that you can find a rat that might be able to to also have this attestable deficit. Mm. And so there are certain kinds of models. Some of them are genetic. Like there's a rat that has a it's a mouse that has a particular deletion of a type of receptor, of a glutamate receptor, and this so-called NR1 NMDA or glutamate receptor subtype 1 deletion, it tends to look kind of like it has negative symptoms, like it doesn't explore as much, it doesn't go out into the open, it doesn't feed the same way, it tends to be less social. And so this is something that, you know, that mouse model, you could potentially test with this different kinds of medicines and see whether you could restore some of the social and kind of the sort of willingness of it to explore or be social or how kind of anxious it seems. There are ways to test those things, at least in a basic kind of way. So that's one approach that you can use. You can use a model, in this case, a genetic model that I just described, but there are many possible models. But it's not like there are not models, there are not animal models of schizophrenia. I mean, it's some people get confused with that because they think, you know, a rat can't have schizophrenia, a mouse doesn't have schizophrenia. Of course it doesn't, because we define schizophrenia as a clinical syndrome with, it's an inherently human disease. You know, a mouse doesn't hallucinate. Or if it does, we could never know, you know. But these neurocognitive or electrophysiological deficits, or even ventriculomegaly, even this, you can do certain things to mice that can cause them to have expansion of their ventricles as part of their development. And so these are ways that you can use animals to look at certain biological features of people with schizophrenia, and that is a way that you can test potential treatments, I think that's how a lot of the treatments are getting to the point of being tested these days. That they go through a series of animal tests that meet certain characteristics for being an effective antipsychotic, and then they are tried at some point when they're deemed to be safe enough, they're tried in a human population. And first they start out usually in human volunteers that are healthy, not people with schizophrenia. And then after you have sort of established that they are safe to administer to humans, because those initial studies are done in very controlled inpatient settings where people are admitted and monitored carefully for a period of time. After there has been enough exposure of a medication, then you can go on to test in patient populations. And you know, the IRB, the Institutional Review Boards, participate all along the way to kind of determine, they deem, you know, what's judged to be safe at any given time for a certain drug, and to make sure that, you know, that there is adequate safety. So it's not it's not just that investigators are going out and testing these drugs without any regulation on people who have these very serious disorders, and certainly there would be, you know, the potential for inappropriate studies and, you know, sort of, you know, potentially unethical kind of studies being done. But that's just not how the system has been evolved into that. You know, these institutional review boards are the complete arbiters of, you know, what's allowed to be done. And a group of completely independent physicians and people from the community make the decisions of, you know, when can a medication or a potential medication be tested?
Mm-hmm. Well, you brought up the topic of what's doing the right thing with trials and experiments and making sure to keep some ethical guidelines. You're trying to prevent undue harm to people. One other prescription of what the right way to do research is to publish negative results, to say in writing so that the rest of the scientific community can know, we tried something and it just didn't work. Like, we didn't find anything. Mm-hmm. So now we know that this particular protein isn't a hope for a treatment or anything like that. And as I was looking through your research, there was a trial like that. And I thought, well, that's great. There's a lot of worry in the scientific community, I think, that there's too much suppression of negative information, that we didn't find anything, and too much emphasis in the big journals that publish scientific papers of, we found something that seemed to work this one time, and then maybe people aren't even careful about doing that experiment again to make sure that this drug really works the way it's supposed to. So tell us about, from your experience, how much of a problem there is with people suppressing experiments that don't work out the way they hoped, and what you've done to counteract that.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I have the sort of dubious honor maybe of having recently published a negative result. But I think that, you know, you use the word suppress, and I think that there would be situations when a negative finding, it might be in the interest of whoever did the study to potentially not publish that. But on the other hand, I think that, and that's usually around the, I think, you know, you can at least imagine how it might come up around when there's a financial sort of consequence that is tied to the outcome of the trial.
They might lose their grant money.
So you might, well, I would say more, it would be like a study that was done by, maybe funded by a pharmaceutical company, where the pharmaceutical company was very interested in showing that a particular medication that has moved along quite far into treatment, in development, but it has not yet received FDA approval. They could have poured hundreds of millions of dollars into such a study and into such a medication, and then they get a negative result, and you know, you could just imagine, and that sort of not publishing that could be suppressing it, and I think that in the reviews that have been done, looking at all of the different trials of psychiatric medications, and seeing what's been published and what hasn't, there certainly have been instances of showing drug companies that have not published a lot of data. It usually wasn't around the main indication, because it's hard to kind of say that, well, a study that was being done, well, we're just not going to talk about the results. Like, there are sort of safeguards for that not happening so much. But associations with maybe certain specifics about that study just might not become known.
Maybe certain side effects wouldn't be.
Yeah, potentially emphasized. Side effects. But I think your question about, I think there are also, you know, there tends to be excitement about things that work, and there tends to be less excitement about things that don't work. And so I think even from investigators who are, you know, very busy and are trying to do, you know, all the things that they need to do to sort of, you know, get grants and get funding and write up the papers for the positive findings and do all the other things that they need to do, sometimes if they have a negative result, you know, there are certainly instances when I know that, you know, negative studies that showed a negative result don't necessarily get published just because there wasn't enough interest and there wasn't enough there wasn't a need for them to publish that. However, you make the, you know, what is a really important point is that that's really actually very important information, because in part it shows you what it isn't. I mean, it shows you that for anyone who might have that idea in the future, it should sort of give pause to whatever researcher might say, why don't we try to use a GABA-2 agonist like we did to enhance cognition in schizophrenia, because we thought, well, that, based on what we know from the postmortem neurobiology or neuropathology, enhancing the action of this receptor that seems to be abnormal in patients with schizophrenia might actually improve their cognition. Well, it turned out that when we gave this particular drug, MK0777, it just, nothing happened. I mean, it just didn't make really any difference in terms of enhancing the working memory or the attention span or the things that we were particularly hoping, you know, it might help with. And then you also struggle with the fact that you're not usually going to be able to, the journals themselves are, you know, they get so many submissions these days for work that's being done, especially the higher quality journals. So the higher quality journals are often going to say, you know, this is interesting, but it's not interesting enough that we just don't have room to publish it. And so you might submit something to a journal and then find that, well, they just send it right back and say, sorry, you know, thank you for submitting this, but we're not able to consider it at this time. And you might do that to a few different journals, and you might just throw up your hands and say, you know, I'm not able to get this negative study published. Now we were fortunate with this particular study that I think that the we were addressing a very specific biological hypothesis, and I think we had laid out the rationale for trying this very, very carefully. And so the fact that it was a negative study, like you pointed out, the journal editors, you know, fortunately felt like this is really worthwhile information, and it should be out there, and we're just, you know, we're going to accept it. But it's not always that clear cut, and it's not always that it's being suppressed, which sounds, you know, kind of devious and kind of inappropriate. There may be a variety of reasons why data isn't published. I think on a smaller scale, when you're dealing with NIH-funded studies, federal dollars, or individual investigators doing studies, I think most of us try to publish all the studies that we do, but whether they're positive or negative. But it may be more that when there's sort of when you have pharmaceutical companies and large kind of money riding on the outcomes, historically that may be where there has been research that hasn't gotten published. And I think that there's a lot of effort on the national level, federal level, to sort of make sure that that doesn't happen. And in part, there's a need to register all clinical trials. Every study that you do with patients needs to be registered in the so-called clinicaltrials.gov. It's a national database that you lay out the goal of the study and usually the inclusion-exclusion criteria and what you're going to find, what you're planning to find, what you're trying to test, and so if it's known that this has been registered, and then nothing ever comes out from it, you know, there's gonna be sort of follow up with what happened with that study, and you can't just sort of leave it. It's not like it just didn't happen, because this is now tied kind of to sort of federal registers that there will ultimately sort of need to be some accountability for that.
Right, and this applies to any clinical study is funded with federal money, or just?
Well, it really has to do with all studies, and so you need to register studies, even if it's not. So, I mean, all pharmaceutical funded studies also register there, and you can't. And like the FDA, you know, if you're a pharmaceutical company and you hope to get your product, your drug, FDA approved, which is the goal of every pharmaceutical company, you know, they have to demonstrate that their trials were registered with clinicaltrials.gov. So they can't really get around that.
I see.
So there are more and more safeguards that have been built into the system, but it's still not perfect. But, you know, I think people are trying to make it as perfect as it, you know, can be.
Right. It sounds like there's progress. I've heard people ask, though, wouldn't it be nice if journals just accepted research based on the merit of their methodology, or if they were accepted before the results came in, so they would be blind to the negative or positive result? So there are ideas floating around to make progress that are a little more radical, I guess, than what's been tried.
Right.
Well, I want to end by looking at one subset of the research you've done on schizophrenia and on antipsychotics. You've looked at side effects, different profiles of side effects, and maybe how to ameliorate them, or which side effects are worse with which drugs or with which groups of patients. So tell us, for example, about the metabolic problems that can come with certain antipsychotics or obesity, for example, and how you've researched that.
Right. So, antipsychotics as a group, there's almost no antipsychotic out there that hasn't caused at least some people to gain weight. And some antipsychotics are notorious for weight gain, and others are less so, but still problematic. And the fact is that, you know, people with schizophrenia or other psychotic problems have to take an antipsychotic, really. I mean, there's just no real way around it. And so the result is that by virtue of taking these medicines, a lot of people are gaining weight. And it's turning out that it's really... it's really sort of gained epidemic proportions. I mean, I think that it's just there's a syndrome called metabolic syndrome that's sort of a when people have this problem, they're particularly prone to getting heart disease. And metabolic syndrome includes low levels of good cholesterol, high levels of bad cholesterol, hypertension, and sort of evidence that you're getting closer to diabetes, not necessarily having diabetes, but kind of pre-diabetes, as well as what we call abdominal obesity. So kind of the gaining of weight, particularly in the abdomen. And if you have that, it looks like in some large studies, almost half of the people with schizophrenia meet criteria for this metabolic syndrome. So it just suggests that, it's a big problem. And very little research has been done looking at how can we help people just very basically, on a very basic level, how can we help them lose weight? And sort of FDA-approved weight loss agents, like stimulant-type medicines that are available, you can get them mostly through prescription. Most of these drugs are risky to take for people with schizophrenia. They kind of work in a way that's completely opposite to what you want an antipsychotic to do. They actually stimulate, they enhance dopamine transmission in areas that you don't want dopamine to be enhanced, and it can produce psychotic symptoms. So giving FDA, there's one exception, but most weight loss drugs are really contraindicated for people with schizophrenia, and there's one that has been tested that stays in the gut. It's called orlistat. It wasn't effective, at least in one study that was done in schizophrenia.
It was effective.
It was not. So we've recently looked at and completed a study that looked at metformin, which is a drug that is used to treat diabetes. But it's fairly unique among those diabetes drugs that it can be given to people that don't have diabetes because it normalizes blood sugar. It doesn't make it go into sort of abnormally low levels, which would happen with most diabetes drugs. And so it turns out that when people take metformin, they lose at least modest amounts of weight, and it seems to improve... again, modestly, the cholesterol profile, such that you get small but measurable reductions in both triglycerides and some of the other bad cholesterol, and it also can help people who are in this pre-diabetes state, is where you don't quite meet the criteria for diabetes, but you're at increased risk for developing diabetes, And again, people with schizophrenia have twice the rate of diabetes than the population in general. So it's about 15% of people with schizophrenia have diabetes.
And is the suggestion that this is caused by the antipsychotics?
I think it's logical, that it's really caused by it. I think we haven't shown that. I mean, it's difficult to say that it's bond. But the guilt by association is very strong.
Yeah.
And I think that... the idea that, you know, we need to sort of figure out some ways of starting to reverse and obviously, you know, diet and exercise always need to be part of any sort of weight loss regimen and improved kind of healthy behaviors. But part of it, I think, needs to be, I mean, just the reality is we need to try to develop some actual drug treatments as well.
Right.
And I think metformin, and there have been a few small studies, and we just completed the largest study to date. We studied almost 150 patients with metformin versus placebo. And we showed that metformin did cause, you know, over 16 weeks, it caused about a 3 kilogram weight loss in the patients, so, which is about, you know, 6 pounds, which is modest, but it was still, it was demonstrating, it was consistent with what has been found in smaller studies, and we also showed it in a more general population. We showed it in just kind of, which hadn't been done before, that it was really effective in anyone who was overweight, who was taking an antipsychotic, and by and large, they tolerated this pretty well.
Right. Dr. Yarskog, we're going to have to wrap up, but I'm glad you're doing your work. It's definitely an important pursuit to try to get drugs to work for people in a way that's really part of the fullest recovery possible. So thank you for that. And thank you for coming on Psych Talk.
Thank you very much.
Find us at psychtalkradio.com or on Facebook and Twitter, and send us an email. The address is psychtalk@wcomfm.org. Thanks.